morning, members. Committee can come to order. Welcome. Apparently, we were on Minnesota Public Radio this morning, as this being the inaugural hearing of the new Labor and Consumer Protection Committee. I've heard rumor. It's wrong, but that's the media. I hope they're not listening. I'd like to welcome you all. We do have, we are continuing the presentations that we began last week from different departments and interest groups. With that, I'm very pleased that we have Commissioner of the Department of Commerce and several of the deputies here to present an overview of the Department of Commerce for us. Commissioner, welcome.
Good morning and thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
If you, Commissioner, would please introduce yourself for the tape and begin.
Yes, I'm Glenn Wilson, Commerce Commissioner. Thank you again for this opportunity. One of the things that I think that is important is to get a perspective of the scope of the committee. We have a very, very broad portfolio of activity, and almost 100% of what we do in the department is related in some way to a consumer protection, which you all are most interested in. So that's pretty much the focus of the department, but to kind of give a flavor of the breadth of it, we have oversight on the relay telephone system, where the hearing impaired enter the system, and we have 986,000 calls that are transmitted on behalf of the hearing impaired in the state so well that most people don't realize that it's going on. There's 156 people employed in Moorhead to do this. Anyway, that gives a flavor of the breadth of the department, and there are many other areas like that. One of the things that I thought that I would briefly read a letter to you this morning, which I often get, that is reflective, I think, of the overall department, and I'll indulge you for just a minute here. On May 15th, my husband, Tom Rojas, passed away about a month ago. I realized that I was in a no-win battle with the two insurance companies. Someone recommended that I call the Department of Commerce. The person who answered the phone that day was Bubba Aguilar. He listened to me very patiently as I described what I was going through with the insurance companies. Over the next few months, Bubba made the phone calls for me that I didn't want to make or that I was too frustrated to make. He constantly kept in touch with me, returned my calls promptly, sat in on a conference call with me with a representative of one of the companies, and he heard the lies that I was being told by them. On October 31st, I received my final insurance payment 5.5 months after my husband's death. I truly do believe that I still would not have my husband's insurance money without the help of Bubba. I want to thank the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and especially Bubba, for helping me through these very tough times in my life. Nancy Rojas. That's reflective of a lot of the work that we do in the department. Very, very quickly, I'll introduce the staff as they come down, but all have been with the key people, have been with the department through the first administration, plus they have additional federal and state experience. So not only they, but the 313 members of the staff have significant experience. 63 of the 313 have advanced degrees, engineering, accountants, actuaries. So I feel as though I can take with a considerable amount of confidence the data and information that's relayed to me for meetings such as this and with others. The total department revenue is $445 million. The total expense for the department is $305 million. But more importantly, when you look at the general fund budget, there's $211 million of revenue and $39 million worth of expense. That's 18.6% expense against the revenue of the department. And I could go into this series but in the areas that the income and expense, but I'll leave that for another time. Probably the most important thing that we've gotten done in the first 4 years of this administration was that we focused on improving systems. After 40 years of experience in business, It was my opinion, frankly, that we were as many as 20 years behind times in the systems that our department was trying to operate with. And we dealt with, so that there was way too much time spent on passing paper around, making copies, and took away from the real business of what the department's all about. We've increased the efficiency of the department in many, many ways. And I'll give you just a very quick example. We installed 14, because of the breadth of the department, you have to understand it takes a lot of systems to operate within those business lines. So we put 14 new systems in and have as many as 50 subsystems to handle all the breadth. Unclaimed properties has doubled in the number of claims that we pay out, the number of pieces of property that we take into the department. So we were able to significantly reduce the amount of time, which got anywhere from a couple months to 6 months behind, depending on workload times, down to where we're consistently within 30 days. Same way with licensing, it used to take months to get a license through. We'd have 50 people lined up every morning. Today, you ring a bell to get in the department because most of it's being done online. So same way with the paper docs, electronic insurance, papers, forms and files for insurance and the energy area was millions of paper pieces of paper. That's all electronically received, redacted out, the trade secret information stored and retrieved by anybody that wants to access that material. Very quickly, I mentioned the unclaimed property area already. One of the important areas of the state that people recognize is weights and measures, but have no idea of the breadth of that department as well. We do hit 6,300 locations in the state, mostly gas stations and food weighing equipment. But many businesses, 600 major businesses in the state, are dependent on the metrology lab for keeping the calibration of their equipment up to date. It doesn't matter whether it's iron ore trucks, railroad cars, or pill weighing equipment. So it is a critical piece. We also there do petroleum testing in our labs. The petro fund is another area that has probably lost some of the public interest because the large sites have been identified and cleaned up in our state. But there continues to be more work for the department because there's more smaller sites. It's gone up from 1,400 to 1,700 sites that we work on. But the number of dollars to clean up these smaller sites means that our budget has dropped from $16 million to $12 million in that area. So those are just some of the highlights on the areas that we focus on. I'd like to have the deputies talk about the particular areas of their department. So I'd like to start with the Energy and Telecom, Mr. Garvey, that came from the Public Service Commission, where he was chairman before coming to the department. Edward?
Good morning, Mr. Garvey. Welcome. Please introduce yourself to the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you, Commissioner Wilson, for that introduction and overview of the department. My name is Edward Garvey. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Energy and Telecommunications at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. My division has somewhere about 80 full-time staff people. Our primary roles and responsibilities to oversee the state's electricity, natural gas, and telephone service providers. Our mission is to provide, promote reliable, low-cost, environmentally secure energy systems. And in this capacity, with Governor Pawlenty and Commissioner Wilson's oversight, I'm the point person on the Governor's Next Generation Energy Initiative that he announced and spoke about at the State of the State earlier this week, talking about more renewables, more efficiency, and less carbon. More specifically, and I think the issue that this committee like to hear about today is the consumer assistance and protection that my division provides. We provide assistance and protection in three different ways. One of the more important ways is providing direct answers to direct customer, consumer, citizen questions. We have the State Energy Information Office. This is a place where citizens call to get information on how to do more energy conservation and efficiency, how to weatherize their home, what kind of appliances they should buy, In 2006, last year, we had 71,500 direct contacts. Many of them were by phone. Many were through the booths that we set up at convention sites, at conferences, at schools, and those kinds of things. We have an additional 76,000 web hits to our information site. So we provide direct communications on energy efficiency and communications to the public day in, day out. Another way that we provide a lot of assistance and protection from the public is through direct financial assistance. We do this in two ways. We are the conduit and the provider of low-income energy assistance money to those that are in financial assistance during the winter months. $80 million or thereabouts flow through our department, through state cap agencies to citizens in need to help them pay for their energy costs. We do more than just providing direct financial bill paying. We also help weatherize their homes. Last year, we helped weatherize over 3,500 homes. All of these are for low-income folks, because not only helping them pay their bills is important, but helping them reduce their bills is also important. Commissioner Wilson mentioned Telephone Access Minnesota. That's the hearing, the program that we use to help those with hearing impaired. Not only do we serve the Minnesotans with over a million, almost a million, as Commissioner Wilson indicated, almost a million relay calls, but we serve through that capability many citizens from around the country because we have one of the best programs. Another part of our role is to provide information on grants. People call us frequently for saying, we think there might be money, we have a good idea, where can we find a grant? We provide that kind of resource. The third resource that we provide is the public interest protection and oversight of our utilities. Working with the Public Utilities Commission, we are the entities that make sure that they provide just and reasonable rates and high-quality service. We respond to consumer complaints when we get them. We also basically review their rates to make sure that they're fairly treating the citizens in a way that they're not taking advantage. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in the Energy Division, we spend a lot of time working directly and indirectly with Minnesotans to protect them, to serve them, to help them. And I hope that that's answered the questions that you may have, and if you have any other questions specifically, I'd be happy to answer to the best of my ability.
It looks like you covered the territory. Thank you, Mr. Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to introduce the Financial Exams Division Deputy, Kevin Murphy. Mr. Murphy was recruited to the department 9 years ago as the finance solvency person and deputy, as well as having had a significant experience at the federal level examining federal banks.
Good morning, Mr. Murphy. If you'd introduce yourself for the tape and then present. Thank you.
Kevin Murphy, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner Wilson. Deputy Commissioner of the Financial Examinations Division. I spent 17 years as a federal bank regulator in my previous life. That was followed by 12 years as a private sector consultant in the banking world. I was hired at the end of the Carlson administration by a bipartisan search committee. I was reappointed by both the Ventura and the Valenti administration. For those of you that are doing the math, I started with the Feds when I was 12. My division licenses to regulate state banks, credit unions, finance companies, check cashers, payday lenders, and the like. We handle the financial regulation and insurance company, by that I mean the solvency. We also do the licensing of mortgage originators under Chapter 58. We have about 75 people who use some outside contractors in some of our work. Our division is pretty much self-funded. We charge the industries for what we do. you people appropriated this money and then we fill the industries to cover the cost. A lot of our work relates to making sure that the banks, credit unions, and insurance companies are solvent and have the money to honor customer deposits and make claims on insurance companies. It's easy to take this for granted. We haven't had a lot of failures in Minnesota for many, many years, but this doesn't happen automatically. And we try to strike the balance between having a lot of competition, a lot of competitors, and a lot of choices for financial products on one side of the ledger. On the other side of the ledger, we don't want any failures, just losses and inconvenience to consumers, so we try to strike that balance. So we conduct hundreds of examinations throughout the year. We haven't had any state banks fail since the year 2000. There haven't been any credit union failures since the mid-80s. We have dealt with several troubled situations, though, which you don't read about in the newspaper. We arrange some shotgun weddings. We do enforcement actions. We try to resolve these things quietly so the public doesn't need to be concerned about it. We have 85 or so domestic insurance companies that we oversee very directly, and we license another 1,300 that are headquartered in other states, but they're licensed to operate in Minnesota. The insurance regulation is shared with all the other states. We've had very good success in regulating insurance companies. There's not been a Minnesota company that's failed in many, many years. We've had a handful of companies licensed in other states that were licensed here that have failed over the years, but in every case, the problem with the insurance industry is they could be in good shape when they're licensed right here and sell some policies. Policies last for 15 or 20 years, and then their financial situation deteriorates and stop them from selling new business, but they still have the old business here in Minnesota. But we have a guarantee fund mechanism in the insurance world, which is a little bit like the FDIC, but when an insurance company fails, the industry passes the hat and makes it good. We fortunately haven't had to resort to that in Minnesota in many years. Our examinations of finance companies, we have two people that do that. In the last couple of years, they've been responsible for identifying almost 700,000 in overcharges that have been refunded to consumers. Last year, we ordered one payday lender to refund 50,000 in overcharges to consumers. You see many stories in the news media these days about so-called alternative mortgages, and by this I mean no-money-bound loans, loans with negative amortization where the balance actually gets bigger, loans with low teaser rates that escalate sharply after a couple of years. That's contributing to foreclosures and other bad things for consumers. Last fall, the federal bank regulators issued guidelines to the banking industry concerning their expectations on those kind of loans, and we adopted those same guidelines in December and issued those to state-licensed non-bank mortgage lenders that do business in this state. That's the same guidelines that the feds issued, and the purpose, it's a long document, it's on our webpage, but the thrust of it is to encourage lenders to make meaningful disclosures to consumers considering these loans, and that would include a worst-case situation. So the customer may be able to afford the teaser rate, but we want to also make sure that they can afford the payments after the payments escalate. Also, the guidelines require more careful underwriting, so lenders don't get people into products that they can't afford. And those guidelines are on our webpage. There have been a lot of stories about the mortgage industry in the newspaper recently, and that industry certainly needs some work, and we'll be coming to you later in the session with a proposal to improve the regulation of mortgage brokers. The regulation of mortgage brokers in Minnesota started in I think 1999, relatively recent, and it's kind of a licensing scheme where we license mortgage companies. We also license independent contractors that do business with mortgage companies. We have a large volume of people that are licensed, and that legislation was probably pretty good when it started out, but it needs some more work. So we're going to propose that any licensee under Chapter 58 must be a corporation or other business entity. Will require a substantial net worth and or charity bond requirements. We're finding that a lot of people are in this business on a part-time basis and they don't have much skin in the game. And we find abusive tactics and we go back to get after those people. We found that they've blocked up the doors, have taken off because they just don't have any reason to take care of them. So people have some skin in the game. They'll be more likely to face the music. We'll propose mandatory training for loan officers. Licensees will have to maintain a roster of loan officers, and they already have to do background checks on those people. That was put in by the Commerce Department a couple of years ago. A big item, the Commerce Department will be authorized to examine these companies and to charge for the examinations. And we will propose to make mortgage fraud a specific crime in Minnesota with substantial penalties. Just looking at the short term, we can continue to pass laws to reduce bad practices and respond to what we see as bad behavior, but over the long term fix, I believe, is that financial literacy in Minnesota needs substantial improvements. And I think that needs to start in the grade school level. Our people need to learn how to be better and smarter consumers. Financial products that we're faced with these days are complicated even for sophisticated people. So for an unsophisticated consumer, it's bewildering. So I think the long-term fixes and improved financial literacy. We're pretty heavily involved in that effort. That's my prepared remarks, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to answer any questions.
Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Murphy, you still have real estate brokers and real estate licenses under your purview, correct?
Mr. House, those are under Patrick Nelson's division, please.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. He's next?
Yes.
I'll save it for them. Thank you.
Mr. Murphy, if you could just review, you'd reference to your department overseeing payday lenders and some return last year of overcharges. I presume that's of fees to consumers?
Mr. Chairman, found a payday lender that was also charging a check cashing fee on top of the already exorbitant payday loan fee, so we ordered them to reimburse that to customers. It was in the neighborhood of $50,000.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Murphy? Oh, Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Murphy, could you tell me how widespread a problem mortgage fraud is?
Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's hard to get good numbers on that, but it feels to me like it's very widespread. Mm-hmm.
Representative.
Another question, please. You talked about the need for financial literacy in our schools. Can you just give me a brief little overview of what kind of work you've done on that and what you plan to do in the future? I've been very interested in that topic and actually introduced the bill last session, and so I'm curious as to where you're at with that.
Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chairman. I got interested in this topic a couple of years ago, and it finally occurred to me that the average consumer really is no match for the big financial institutions and financial products. And I convened a group of people, an educator, a volunteer, a former school superintendent, and another person in my department, and a person from the Minnesota Credit Union Network, and we just sat down and started talking about it. And what we found out is that there's a lot of people working in this area. There's no end to materials and curriculums and programs that can be taught. Unfortunately, the delivery system is not as good as the volume of materials that are available. I wrote a letter to the Commissioner of Education somewhere in there, required financial literacy of schools, and I was advised back that the local school districts have pretty much control over the curriculum. So about a year ago, I wrote a letter to all of the school districts. We had, in a little study group, we had identified a curriculum that's put forth by a nonprofit group in Colorado, and I think it's the National Endowment for Financial Education or something like that. It's a nonprofit, and the materials are not geared to any one industry. They're pretty neutral, and it was a relatively short curriculum, 6 units that could be taught together or separately. We wrote all the school districts and advised them that this curriculum was available. It looked pretty good to us, and it was free. And these people were provided for free. And while working with that group, I became involved with the Jumpstart Coalition Group, which is a Minnesota nonprofit that has as its mission enhancing financial literacy for Minnesota youth. And I'm on the board of directors of that, and that's been going for about 1 year now. And that, we're still beginning to find our way and try to figure out exactly what we're doing, but we're trying to act as a clearinghouse for information for people interested in financial literacy. And the key members of that group are educators from high schools and are people from the industry, just a variety of people. So we'll be asking the governor to declare April to be Financial Literacy Month in Minnesota. We're trying to develop some more interest in that area. I believe that and there are any number of people that are working on this. Part of the University of Minnesota Extension Service, they train teachers to teach financial literacy. I went to a dinner in the fall put on by a component of the university that's involved in this. I think it's their Applied Economics Department. And they were honoring educators who were doing outstanding work in this area. And they had a third grade teacher from, I think, Mendota, who talked about teaching economics to third graders, and she said the kids loved it. And my initial focus was at the high school level, but I'm beginning to believe that that needs to start early on. And if you think about it, the way people conduct their everyday lives is based on economics, and if they can make smart decisions and they're prepared to deal with complex financial products, then I think we would need laws and regulations if we have the informed consumer. We have a very competitive marketplace which tends to drive down the cost, but the flip side of that is you need a very informed consumer to make that work. So I think that's where we need to be spending more time and effort.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Benson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Murphy, does your department get into issues such as financial institutions that send out these checks that one can sign and cash, and considering the issues of identity theft and so, does your department get into that area at all?
Representative,
Mr. Murphy.
We have a statute that limits some of those non-solicited checks. Another area that's come up recently, we have some state banks in Minnesota that are in the business of handling deposit accounts for big companies that offer rebates. Like if you buy a computer or you buy TurboTax or something like that and you apply for a rebate, those checks get cleared through a couple of relatively small Minnesota banks. And we had some reports where the backside of the check would have some language on it that would be very detrimental to the consumer, and it appeared to this bank. So we've been in discussions with that bank on how to better deal with that issue.
Chairman and
Representative,
in this case, I mention it because I had written a couple of times to this financial institution to stop sending these things, and they just keep coming anyway. Another issue I'm just wondering about, does the idea of usury, when we think of lending fraud and so, is that a term that is relevant now? You know, the upper limits and how much interest can be charged, for example, is it 21% or is it is that concept gone?
Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the usury statute laws are still with us. They're incredibly complicated. Basically, first mortgage residential loans are deregulated. We have a tremendous market, a lot of competition. There still is no rate regulation. And the problem with rate regulation, if you have a period of high interest rates,
yeah,
12 or 13%, if you cap the loans at 8, nobody makes any loans.
Right.
So, on the other kinds of consumer loans, the limit is generally 21.75%, which is exorbitant. Of course, fortunately, most people don't have to pay that because they shop around and get the best deal. On the banking world, there are a lot of federal preemptions of a lot of state laws, so banks tend to be headquartered in states that have very high usury limits or no usury limits. For all the credit card banks are located either in Delaware or South Dakota, and they're able to export their interest rates. So it's an incredibly complicated area.
Yeah.
And, I think the informed consumer is probably a better regulator than some of the usury laws. But they're still needed to put some outer limits on egregious behavior.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Murphy, as well as the Commissioner, one thing that I know you started is a fraud investigative unit, and we mentioned identity theft and things like that. How is that fraud investigative unit going, particularly focused on senior citizens? We have a tremendous amount of money that the senior citizens, people my age,
No.
All right. 63. I qualify.
AARP is later on the agenda.
I joined a long time ago. But I think I really admired your effort. I want to know how you're doing in that. I think you're going to be having quite a law enforcement force, I believe.
Mr. Chairman, Member Gunther. That was funded about 2 years ago, and it took us a little while to get everybody hired and in place. It took physical exams, psychological exams, and so it was slow getting up to speed. But we do have large cases and significant number of cases that have already been filed for prosecution. In fact, one thing to remember, though, our department has licensed in 20 industries, and so it's very broad. The fraud unit is limited to insurance fraud, and so we can't use it like to, although frankly we have used their counsel to refer cases for prosecution. And last month we had about 10 cases that went to prosecutors. And the other thing about that group, and it is, I think, important to all of you, is that we work there with other agencies, so that the postal inspector, the U.S. Marshal, U.S. Attorney's Office, HUD, the FBI, a lot of the cases that we work up, we ask other agencies to pick up because they have either more expertise, broader range, or federal law is stronger than state law. The people that were prosecuted in Utah last month and got 8 years and 4 years because they were out of state and the federal law was a lot stronger, we turned it over to the FBI and they pursued our case for us. But I appreciate the opportunity to comment on it because it is helping significantly.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Murphy? Seeing none, Mr. Murphy, thank you. If we could wrap up the presentation then with Mr. Nelson.
Yes, Pat had spent 8 years with the department in the Carlson administration, was in private practice for 4 years, came back 4 years ago as the deputy in the market assurance division. Pat?
Mr. Nelson, welcome. If you'd introduce yourself for the tape.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. For the record, my name is Patrick Nelson, and as the Commissioner indicated, I've been at Commerce in different capacities and times for over a dozen years. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning to discuss consumer protection. To some degree, everything we do in my unit relates to consumer protection. And as the Commissioner indicated, we have a good number of knowledgeable, dedicated people who work hard for the needs of Minnesota consumers. There's approximately 82 people in this division. And to protect the consumer, we use several different methodologies. And we have some impact on over 20 industries. But as you probably know, the big three are insurance, real estate, and securities. And generally, all these industries involve money in the importance of the transaction with the consumers has risen to a level where society is deemed through you guys, the legislature, that it needs some form of governmental protection. And the methods we use, we can break it down into three basic areas: enforcing the state laws and safeguarding consumer rights. The other method we use is resolving conflicts between the consumers and the industry. And then the third method is enhancing the stability and strength of financial and other regulated industries. And you could even break that down a little bit further, and I like to call it front-end and back-end regulation for simplicity. Front-end regulation is there are many types of products and or companies that have to sort of apply to us to be able to enter our market. Policy analysis is a good example. Many insurance policy forms and rates have to be approved by the department before they're eligible to be sold. And even if they can be sold, they still have to be reviewed, and we can impact them post accessing the market. Self-insurance on work comp, that would be an example of where we look at financial stability. Before you can self-insure in work comp, which is a division in my unit, you have to prove that you have the financial wherewithal to protect the workers. Back-end regulation is what I would call the type of regulation that when people have already entered into a financial transaction and it doesn't go the way they thought it would, they call us either to file a complaint or just for assistance in working through with the industry, mostly insurance. And I'll sort of quickly go through, I know we're short on time, sort of the different divisions here, and I'll just briefly what they do, and I'll kind of end up with the consumer response team because that was maybe more what is traditionally thought as consumer protection. So I already covered a little bit policy analysis. They review insurance rate form and filings. The head of that has got, Brian Pennington's got 30 years experience. We've got workers' comp self-insurance, a big program, over 1,000 companies, and they're including subsidiaries, are self-insured for work comp. We have a securities unit that reviews registrations. As you know, securities is jointly regulated by the feds, the SEC, and us. And over the years, the state role in that has diminished to some degree. But you still need either a federal registration or an exemption from registration to have your security sold in Minnesota. The other big area that was mentioned is licensing. Licensing, we license about 244,000 individuals. For example, it's like 55,000 resident insurance producers, brokers on the real estate side is about 7,000, agents on the real estate side is about 25,000. So that's a big program, and as the Commissioner has indicated, we've done substantial system review there, and we're still in the process of doing substantial system review there. We just recently went online with insurance producer renewals, and we did 37,000 in the month of November in a month, and in years past that would have taken months and months to finish the process there. We are rolling out basically the same system for real estate agents. The go-live date is currently February 28th, so it should be in place for the next renewal cycle. On the We mentioned the insurance fraud unit, so I won't go into that. That's my newest unit, and it's up and running finally. And I think having a very positive impact on the whole division, the investigative side, the civil investigative side. And I think we do are more cognizant of the criminality of some of the stuff that we investigate and are more ready or more willing to refer people for prosecution than we had in the past. And I think that's partially because we have real police power individuals in the building. On the insurance side, we've got three levels of consumer protection. And the first level is the consumer response team, which basically intakes calls about insurance, about 21,000 last year. If they can deal with it in about one or two phone calls in maybe 3 or 4 days, it actually gets referred to our insurance unit, which has a broader portfolio in terms of time, and it turns into a formal complaint. If we get a lot of complaints or it's a big problem in the insurance market, we also have an insurance market conduct division. Paul Hansen runs that, 21 years of experience. Robert Commodore runs the insurance side of the complaints, 30 years of experience. Nancy Link, who runs the consumer response team, has got 24 years of experience. And they're a unit, as the commissioner read the letter, that basically takes consumer questions and inquiries and tries to do some facilitating between insurance companies and reconciling claims and help them advocate. And they're a very successful outfit. They've had recoveries last year. And we measure recoveries not what the total amount of the claim was, but just the value added that we had. Say that somebody says, my car was a total loss. The company makes an offer of, say, $12,000, and the consumer thinks it's worth $14,500, and we get them $14,000. We don't only count the marginal $2,000 there, and they recovered over $1 million for consumers in fiscal year 06. And then the last team we have is Bonnie Polk, the 35 years, who is heading up the real estate investigations and securities unit. And they have about 7 investigators in real estate and 2 in securities. And I know you're a little short on time, so I'll end with that and stand for questions.
Thank you. Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Nelson. I don't recall the exact date, but it was back in August of last year. I was in Park Rapids with some other members of the legislature. Your office was up there. I'm not sure, Commissioner Wilson, were you there? And I believe I talked to one of your assistants. And, of course, it was campaign season, so we lose track of time and information. But the question I had back then was, you've contracted with a new entity for doing testing for real estate license, broker's license, probably other things too, but the real estate and the broker license was a concern of mine because we had an office, or whoever ran it before had an office in Bemidji, and they closed that. We no longer have one there. So if someone from my district wanted to take their real estate exam, they'd either have to go to Duluth or the next closest one might be Brooklyn Center. And I believe you or your assistant at the time said that you were aware of this new entity doing the testing, that they weren't having as many satellite offices as the other group, but you would look into it and hopefully come up with a solution for those of us that live in rural Minnesota and we don't have to come all the way down to the cities to take that examination. Has anything happened at all?
Mr. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative House, we've not totally resolved that, but we are in the midst of, because one of the things that we are responsible for is the continuing education. A lot of the new licenses require that you have as many as 60 hours of continuing education. You take a test, and we are working diligently to get all those licenses online so that where you take your continuing education, you'll be able to get online to get the testing, and it'll be electronically graded, and you walk out. So we are very cognizant of it, and the system is being
installed as we're here today.
Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a follow-up, you've completed that task. I took my 30 hours of continuing training for real estate sometime in July of last year, and I did everything online, and you sent everything back to me online, and it worked wonderful. It's the initial examination to take the federal and state test to get a real estate license. I would have anyone from my district would have to go to Duluth or to the Twins. You can't do that online. You have to have someone watch you take the test. So I'm hoping that you can find a way to open satellite offices or something, a contract with this individual or company, so people from Bemidji don't have to drive to Minneapolis to take that examination.
Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm very cognizant of that, having been a rural businessman for many years myself before coming here. We really are. It's all part of the license online system and tracking of continuing education. With 20 industries, I just try to be brief. 22,000 courses have been approved. 1,800 are approved every year. 20 industries can take them. You can take them at about 2,000 different locations and over 1 million hours of credit. We were doing that on paper before. Frankly, it wasn't getting done. It was a total bust. Today, that's online. We can track every hour, as you know. The next step there, and frankly, a number of states are doing their initial testing online, and that's what we're studying, the opportunity so that the education provider would also be able to establish a test. And basically what it is a rotating, huge number of rotating questions so that it's very difficult to cheat. And you go and do this, and a number of states are looking at it. And that's what we're trying to get in place.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner.
If I could close with just one quick area of interest. It's my assessment that the optional federal charter is a real risk to state regulatory environment. And I just want your committee, Mr. Chairman, to know that last year our state passed the Interstate Compact, which I think is important to help offset this. But the march goes on by the companies to try to get federal regulation instead of state. And I can tell you that they want to be regulated like a bank. And a bank, federal regulator, takes a consumer complaint, makes a copy of it, and sends it back to the bank. We don't do that. In our customer response team, most of those calls get answered on the first call by somebody that can follow up. That's what we're working very diligently. I wanted you to know that as commissioner on the NAIC and elsewhere, we're doing everything we can to retain the enforcement responsibility for insurance regulation at the state level. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. I know the NCSL has Financial Services Committee has raised significant concerns about that same initiative. So I appreciate your raising that for the committee members. And thank you for your time today. Next, we're honored to have the Attorney General. Ms. Attorney General Swanson, please. Thank you for your patience today. And thank you for taking the time to appear.
Well, absolutely, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I thank you for the opportunity to appear. A big part of what the Attorney General's Office does is consumer protection work, consumer advocacy, so it's great being before the committee to talk about some of that work. As the members of the committee know, the Attorney General's Office does wear many different hats in terms of representing state agencies and whatnot. There are four primary areas where we have primary authority to enforce various civil laws to protect the public and for the benefit of the public. Those four areas are the antitrust laws, the charities and nonprofit regulation laws, the utilities laws, and then finally, of course, the consumer protection laws, and there are many of those consumer protection laws, the three primary ones being the False Advertising Act, the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, and Prevention of Consumer Fraud Act. The Attorney General's Office gets anywhere from 500 to 700 phone calls a day from people in the state of Minnesota having problems. We get about over 100 written correspondences a day from people similarly having problems. And those problems can really run the gamut of different types of complaints. They tend to be things that affect people in their everyday lives. So they tend to be things like mortgages or cars or telemarketing problems, scams, debt collection agencies, things of that nature. And we take those complaints and follow up on each and every one of them in some respect. Sometimes there's nothing that can be done in a particular case. Other instances, you look at them and you find a problem area and it might turn into litigation or a settlement with a particular type of entity. And then in other cases, we are able to use just the advocacy function of the Attorney General's Office to advocate for the citizen who's had a problem and try to work it out and resolve their issues. Some of the kind of the hot issues that I would put on the plate right now in terms of things that are going on, predatory mortgage lending is a huge issue. It's affecting the entire state of Minnesota, cities, suburban areas, rural areas as well. It's an area where we get many, many complaints in the office from people who have been deceived or aggrieved, and it's an area where hopefully there can be some legislation, but also there are other issues at foot in terms of the secondary mortgage markets and whatnot at the federal level. Other areas, insurance. I recently, last week, filed a lawsuit against a life insurance company that had sold annuities to our senior citizens. It was a case that originated out of complaints to the Attorney General's Office from senior citizens saying they saw their net worth, limited life savings, tied up for, you know, in some cases longer than their life expectancy, and if they couldn't get their money back without paying very hefty surrender fees. That's an area that's garnered a lot of national attention, ranging from the New York Times to the LA Times, warning about those types of problems and abuses against senior citizens. So it's an area where I filed a lawsuit and I'm receiving many other complaints in that area. I'm very concerned about it because if you look at the effect on people's lives, it's very great and very serious. Other issues that, as I mentioned, kind of run the gamut, utilities issues are a constant source of complaints, cell phone contracts, things of that nature. People complaining that they didn't understand their cell phone contract or that they were had a contract extended without being adequately told what the terms would be. And that is an area as well where I'm interested in hopefully working with you all to look at some legislation in that area. So that is kind of a very brief overview of the Attorney General's consumer protection functions and what it does. I'm happy to entertain or take any questions if there are any.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you. Welcome to this committee as well as the legislature. And, you know, it seems to me, listening to Commissioner Wilson and his staff, that there are many places where the Attorney General's office and the Department of Commerce overlap. What kind of working relationship do you have with your department with theirs?
Attorney General Swanson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, thank you for the question. We frequently, in the Attorney General's office, make referrals to the appropriate regulatory agency as well, because they're oftentimes our regulators on the hook in terms of these industries where an entity is licensed by a particular regulator. But nevertheless, the consumer protection laws apply to them. And so typically when that happens, if it's a case of a mortgage lender or insurance company, we will also refer the lender to the Commerce Department, the regulatory agency, which wears a regulatory hat and can take licensing action against that type of entity. That's something that happens every day in the office. Thank you.
Other questions for the Attorney General? Please succinct and to the point. Extra credit points.
Very good.
Thank you very much for your time.
I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, members. Thank you so much.
Members, first thing we need to do, is as Mr. Weigel is approaching the front, is approve the minutes from last week's meeting. If there's a motion to approve.
So moved.
Thank you. With that, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
There we go. Good work. We do have about a half a dozen individuals who wanted to come forward. Ms. Weigel from AARP, Brad Leto from the AFL-CIO, Shane Allers from the Change to Win Federation, Mr. Cummins from WICRA, Ron Elwood from Legal Services and Robert Johnson from the insurance industry. We've got about half an hour. If folks could, to the best of their ability, maybe hold their presentations to about 3 minutes, that'll give us a little buffer time for any questions that members may have.
Come to the table in twos.
Come to the table in twos. Find your best friend. And Mr. Weigel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Keith Weigel. I'm the Advocacy Director with AARP Minnesota. We are an advocacy organization. Our membership is for 50 and over. We have almost 670,000 members here in the state of Minnesota, and it's approaching 38 million nationally. Our state office actually officially opened back in 2001. AARP had made a decision that the work that's done at state capitals was important for our members, and we are now officed in all 50 states. So we have a staff of 8 here in the state. I work on advocacy and work in the consumer protection in this area. Heidi Kolsky, who used to be a community administrator for Representative Bradley and spent couple years in the governor's office, is handling our health and long-term care issues. Michelle Kimball, our state director, had 11 years at the national AARP office, and I was in the sixth year here in the state. Typically on for new members and even a refresher for those that have been here, you will expect to see our volunteers both in communicating with you, but also in presenting to the committee. We have a very active group across the state. We do have a state executive council, and our state president is former Attorney General Skip Humphrey. And so a very grassroots oriented approach. I do want to make the comment that as a member organization of 50 and over, our members clearly tell us that what is of concern to their children and grandchildren is also important, so we do try to look at efforts on a multi-generational effort also. But to understand that there is aging, beginning last year, people with the beginning of the baby boomers, someone was turning 60 every 7 seconds, and the middle of that surge turns, there's someone turning 50 every 7 seconds. So we're doing that. We will be very interested in consumer protection issues that are brought before your committee. I just wanted to tell you that from a labor standpoint, we do have a bill that will be coming forward. It has to do with the fact that Minnesota is one of 8 states where if you are an older worker and are drawing Social Security, still working, and then are unemployed, for every $2 of Social Security, $1 of unemployment is subtracted. I would note that about 21 states did that about 5 years ago. 13 of them have gotten rid of it. And our top priority for us will be to correct that here in the state, too. So thank you. Any questions?
Questions from Ms. White? Thank you very much, sir. Brad Leto from the AFL-CIO. Welcome to the committee. If you'd introduce yourself to the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brad Leto, Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And with me is Jennifer Schaubach, who will be working in the legislative area. Has actually internally, but you'll be seeing her more at the Capitol and State Office building here as well. I'll cut down the presentation, and I have in there should be a folder that you have, and you can go through it and call with questions as we go through. I'll just point out a couple of things, there is a slide presentation, and I did not bring the PowerPoint. Actually, it's in the folder because I thought maybe that the committee may be pressed for time, and I thought you probably don't want me to go through that. Just briefly, in the left side of the folder on the front is a document, just a one-page document, just brief information on the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And I did want to point out that on the sense that nearly 20% of Minnesotans belong to unions. They're not all AFL-CIO affiliated unions. In fact, you'll hear from the other large federation in the state Change the Wind shortly. And there are also other unions such as the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. We have good working relationships with all of the unions in the state of Minnesota and exchange information. So I don't want you to think that there's, because there are different federations and different groups, we exchange information, and I can't speak for other states or anything else, but I know in Minnesota we work well together. That point, just on there, on the right-hand side, the legislative goals, which you've all probably received by now, this was the press release version, just wanted to point out probably on the strengthening Minnesota jobs and economy and the on the second page support national legislation and a couple of resolutions. Those would be pretty much the areas of the committee purview. Obviously, we work in a lot of other areas as well. As you can see, we're interested, you know, in budget, tax policy, health care, education, as well as numerous other things that we work, we will lobby on, but we will also lobby on help individual unions with their issues as well. And so just in the other thing on the right hand side I do want to say is that there's an acronym translation is state government, federal government, the military. We're no different in that we love acronyms as well, so that you will see what when I refer to the CWA, it's the Communication Workers Union, etc. I mean, there's just in the presentation, just a couple of things I just want to mention. You don't have to necessarily page here, but you know who we are. It's basically a thousand affiliates, local unions, statewide councils, such as we have local unions within AFSCME, you know, just an example, but they also have a state council. Same with the machinists, the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. They also have a state council besides local unions. Local central labor councils around the state, in the metropolitan area, like the Minneapolis Central Labor Union Council, St. Paul Trades and Labor, you know, the Bemidji Central Labor Council, and they're all over the state. So there we have some constituency groups we work with, and also the Statewide Union Retiree Council. The executive officers are President Ray Waldron and Secretary Treasurer Steve Hunter. You will rarely see President Ray Waldron at the legislature. Last week he was on the road in Worthington and a couple of other places. Yesterday he was in northeastern Minnesota, the day before in northwestern Minnesota. I think he's in Duluth as we speak. He actually does the outreach to all of the other labor councils, labor unions. That's basically what he considers his role is. He will be up here on occasion if we've asked him to come up, or some specific legislator obviously has as well. Steve Hunter, the Secretary of Treasury, will see a little more in two different roles. He follows some legislation with the some of the bonding capital investment legislation and that as well. But he also is in another hat, he is a regent at the University of Minnesota, and he will be here at times, and he will tell you that is the hat he is wearing when he is here on that. And then finally, I just want to mention within the different areas of interest that we have, obviously legislative is what you're concerned about, and we do work on a variety of issues that I mentioned, all the way from, you know, workers' comp, unemployment insurance, wage and hour. And in fact, I do want to mention that I was interested to hear that that Mr. Murphy from the Department of Commerce started at the age of 12. I think there's a child labor violation, perhaps. In there, but, yeah. I did also want Jennifer to mention one thing that she has started this year that might be helpful at times, especially as we get later into session on tracking legislation.
Ms. Shrubach, if you'd introduce yourself for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Shrubach, and I have had the pleasure of working with Brad now for a few years. Behind the scenes, I'm the one that sends you all the emails and letters and things like that. I'm also the one who tracks the legislation as it comes up, all the bills introduced. And we do a bill tracking report for our lobbyists at this point, and this year we decided that we were going to put that online. So if you go to our website, which is listed on just about every piece of paper you have in front of you out of that folder, you can click on At the Capitol and go to the 2007, I believe it's legislative report, bill tracking report. And you can see what we are tracking. Every week it'll be updated, and you can see what exactly the key bills that we're looking at. And if you have any questions, you can always give us a call. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I believe that that will be that's all we really need to cover, and we're happy to answer any questions now or at any time. Feel free to call and get the information or answer any questions we can. Thank you.
Any questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, Mr. Latham, Ms. Shabbat, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The Change to Win Federation. Mr. Makarios, Ms. Beckman. Welcome to the committee. If you'd please introduce yourselves to the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kyle Makarios, and with me is Kristen Beckman. We're obviously not Shane Allers, who's on the agenda, but Mr. Allers sends his regrets. I'm Kyle Makarios. I'm the political director for the Lakes and Plains Regional Council of Carpenters. Kristen Beckman is the executive director of the SEIU, Minnesota State Council. We are here to appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning to speak to you on behalf of the new Labor Federation of Minnesota, the Change to Win Federation. We'll be very brief, and I'll talk briefly about our structure and how we came to be, and then Kristen will talk a little bit about our legislative goals and priorities. In the summer of 2005, seven major unions left the AFL-CIO over some differences in priorities and formed the Change to Win Federation nationally. Those unions are the Service Employees International Union, the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, Unite Here, the Laborers International Union of North America, the International Brotherhood of the Teamsters, the United Food and Commercial Workers, and United Farm Workers. And we have representatives of several of these unions with us today, Wade Luneberg from Unite Here, Todd Poofall from the Laborers, and Jim Boston from the Food and Commercial Workers are joining us in the gallery. Our unions are, in the statewide Change to Win Minnesota, we're led by Brad Slotson Jr. as our chair from Teamsters Local 120, Jay Rakunik is the vice chair from Unite Here, and Shane Allers is our secretary treasurer from SEIU. Our unions are committed to and focused on greatly expanding the promise of the American dream to American workers through growing the labor movement, and particularly focused on growing the labor movement in the service economy and adapting to the unique challenges that the 21st century economy brings to the labor movement. And as Mr. Leto mentioned from the AFL-CIO, you know, while our unions are largely not affiliated directly with the AFL-CIO, we do have a close working relationship with the AFL-CIO and their member unions, and frequently work arm-in-arm closely together with them on legislative and other issues. So with that, I will turn it over to Kristen.
As my colleague said, my name is Kristen Beckman. I'm with SEIU. Briefly, and Mr. Chair, thank you for your invitation to speak today. It is a pleasure to be before you. I think our number one shared priority in the Change to Win Unions is health care reform. You won't necessarily see that here in this committee, but not only for our sort of the social justice commitment to having access, universal access to health care, but also it's the number one reason for labor disputes across the country. For example, our the janitors, who are represented by SEIU Local 26, just took a vote to strike. So 4,200 low-wage workers are ready to strike because of the 4,200 of them, only 14 of them have access to family coverage. And so we have supported proposals across the board, like pooling for K-12 employees, public employees, to be able to pool together to access health care. Sort of nursing home workers pooling together to have access to health care. We're trying all these small fixes. We support universal coverage. So we're working on that together this session. I think our second priority is sort of job creation and the right to organize. Something that it is very, very big importance to sort of our building trades partners and United HRE is that the Mall of America, if expanded, is done with all union labor. And so we'll be very much at the table there. And then also just sort of the general misclassification of construction workers, working on the 1099 issue, working with the Department of Labor on that.
And I think the final thing that I think will probably come before this committee are issues that you'll have to take up are worker protection and training. Things like the packing house worker bill of rights, trying to institute some sort of safety for what is a very dangerous industry. Takes place a lot in our sort of southern part of Minnesota. Also looking at sort of the enforcement of prevailing wage, safe patient lifting, minimum wage indexed to inflation. You know, there are lots of, you know, a broad spectrum since we are sort of building trades and service industry and healthcare workers and all of those things. So we do cover a lot. I do think you'll see all of us up here in different capacities, but we appreciate the chance to just introduce ourselves.
Any questions for either Mr. Macarios or Ms. Beckman? Thank you for your time today. Mr. Cummins. Thank you for a repeat performance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Buzz Cummins. I'm president of the Workers' Compensation Reinsurance Association. You have a handout, I think, in your packets, which lays out a little bit of what we are and how we do it. But given the time constraints, I'll sort of skip through the presentation materials. We are an unusual entity both in Minnesota and nationally. We were created in 1979 by state law, but we operate more like a private company. We are not a state agency, as it specifically states in the statute, and we are governed by our own board of directors, which is composed of insurance company representatives, employer representatives, a public member, Wayne Simoneau, a former member of this body, is our current public member, the Commissioner of Finance, the head of the State Board of Investment, and two labor representatives, Ray Waldron from the AFL-CIO and Don Gertesmeyer from the Teamsters. So our governing body is really kind of an eclectic mix of people of all of the major players in the workers' compensation system. We are designed to provide financial protection to the most catastrophically injured employees in the state of Minnesota. We provide reinsurance, which means we step in when claims reach the catastrophic level and reimburse all of the insurance companies and all of the self-insured entities in the state of Minnesota for damages, for lost wages, and medical costs for the most seriously injured people in our state. With that very brief explanation and adhering to the thought that a picture is worth a thousand words, let me just direct your attention to the umbrella picture in the middle of your packets. That sort of graphically illustrates what the role of the WCRA is. You start at the bottom with a seriously injured employee. He is employed by an employer who may be self-insured or more likely purchases insurance from a workers' compensation insurer. That workers' comp insurer will pay lost wages and medical benefits up to a certain level, either one of three levels, $400,000, $800,000, or $1,600,000. But once the lost wages and medical cost of that very serious claim, and we're talking quadriplegics, paraplegics, serious burns, brain injuries, those kinds of injuries, once they exceed that financial limit identified on the slide, then the WCRA is sort of the financial umbrella of last resort, and we end up paying the benefits as high as they go. And we're talking, in some case, millions and millions of dollars. So that's the role of the WCRA. Just by way of closing, we don't anticipate, or at least I'm not aware of any legislation that will affect the WCRA this year. We've occasionally been surprised, but if all goes well, you won't see me again for a while. But I'd like to direct your attention to the picture at the end of the presentation, and that is the graph comparing medical and indemnity benefits. I know that others are planning some workers' compensation legislation this year, and I would simply like you to bear in mind that for the WCRA, as with the entire workers' comp system, rapidly rising medical costs are a serious problem. For WCRA catastrophic claims, prior to 1992, our actuaries expected, and our experience has shown, that about 40% of the cost of those claims was medical and 60% was indemnity or lost wages. But over the years, largely as a result of rapidly rising medical costs, for a claim that happens today, 90% of that claim we expect to pay out in medical benefits and only 10% in indemnity benefits. So as you're taking a look at the comp system generally, please bear in mind that medical costs are a very, very serious serious factor for all of us who are in that system. With that, Mr. Chairman, I will wrap up. Let me just mention, however, that if you could have any questions, I think my business card is attached to the presentation. Please feel free to call me at any time. Ray Bone, sitting on the top of the gallery there, is our eyes and ears here at the legislature, and please feel free to contact Ray at any time should you have any questions as well.
So we've got at least two members with questions. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cummins, the states of New York and Arizona have reinsurance programs. They're different from each other. Is this program similar to the New York or Arizona programs, or how would you compare what you do with those state reinsurance programs?
Mr. Cummins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, to my knowledge, we are the only workers' compensation reinsurance state-created program. I'm not familiar with the Arizona and New York programs, but I'd be surprised if they were involved in workers' comp.
No, I don't think it's workers' comp, but okay. But that, so you're not aware of those two?
I'm not familiar. I know that Michigan has a state-created reinsurance program for auto insurance, but that's, off the top of my head, the only one I'm really familiar with.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Cummins. How does your group dovetail with the Workers' Comp Insurance Trust in the state of Minnesota, and also the Workers' Comp Trust Fund was what I should have stated, and also then when that fund was somewhat depleted during 03 and 04 because of the budget crisis, how did that affect what you do, if at all?
Mr. Cummins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, I'm not entirely sure which Workers' Comp Trust Fund you're referring to. To my knowledge, we don't have any direct involvement with such a fund. We do not receive, have never received any appropriations from the state of Minnesota to operate the WCRA. We have operated totally independent from state funding, except to the extent that the state of Minnesota is self-insured for work comp, and they pay us a premium for us to provide catastrophic reinsurance for them, just as Cargill does, just as St. Paul Travelers Insurance Company does, and so on. But I'm afraid I can't be responsive to your specific question.
Representative Becker, perhaps you could shed some light.
I think Representative Scalzi is talking about his unemployment trust fund, insurance trust fund. We were about $800 million in the hole in that in 03. We are now finally out of the hole in that. But as far as WICRA is concerned, I have nothing but admiration for their ability to invest money, and I would like to know if they would be willing to invest mine.
Mr. Cummins. Well, and if the answer is yes, can we all pile on?
If the committee would like to give us statutory authority, we'll certainly look at it.
We have our first bill hearing next week. We can always squeeze in a second. Mr. Scales, did you have a follow-up on that? All right. Mr. Cummins, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Ms. Elwood. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Ron Elwood with Legal Services Advocacy Project. I represent Legal Aid, which is the organization statewide that provides free legal assistance to low-income consumers. Just give you a scope of our who we serve. We do handle about 35,000 cases statewide each year, but of course the eligible population is significantly higher than that. According to the last census, there's about 450,000 households, which equates to significantly more number of people who are eligible for some kind of assistance and would qualify as defined as low income. We also will serve any senior citizen, regardless of income. And if you take Mr. Weigel's numbers, about 600 plus thousand. So combined, we probably represent upwards of about 1 million people here in Minnesota. I wanted to highlight about three things for you that I hope the issues that will wind their way before your committee, maybe begin here actually, three important consumer protection issues that we flagged for the session. The first is involving payday lending. What we're going to seek to do this year is 83% of the approximately 215,000 payday loans that are made each year in Minnesota are being made under a statute other than the statute that was intended to govern payday lending. And we'll get into the details on that later, but I think that's a loophole we absolutely need to close and discuss here. The second issue we want to bring before your committee, and by the way, I should actually thank the committee for being in existence, because to have a consumer protection committee is the first in my 10 years here, and maybe the first ever. I don't know. My history will only go back about 10 years here, but I think it's really a great credit that you've recognized consumer protection and recognized it by creating a separate division to address it. So thank you for that. The second issue that I want to flag for you is equity stripping. It's otherwise known as the foreclosure rescue scams. That's the kind of problem that we've encountered, where people who are in foreclosure will be approached by somebody saying, I'll save your home if you deed your property to me, and I'll lease it back to you, and all that. The legislature in 2004 passed a landmark bill, first of its kind in this nation, which has been now copied by several other states. It's a model. It's worked brilliantly to get some of the worst actors out of the business and give consumers the proper tools they need to help themselves when they are victimized. But whenever you pass a good consumer protection law, there's people up late at night thinking about how can we evade it. And we have found several problems where there are bad acts that are not covered by the legislation. They found a way around it, and we're going to come before you with some proposals to close those loopholes. The third and final thing I'd like to flag for you is the issue of the debt management service plan providers. Now, what is that? Those are the things that you see on late night TV where they say, send me your money, you're in debt, we'll deal with your creditors. We'll negotiate better deals, we'll negotiate lower interest rates, we'll make the payments for you, we'll help you get out of debt. There are 8 nonprofit providers of these services in Minnesota. They're the great people, the Lutheran Social Services of the world. They do a wonderful job. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of them out there who are really creating terrible, terrible problems for Minnesota consumers. Terrible abuses in this area. They've been unearthed at the federal level by a Senate subcommittee on investigations, and we're going to come before you to update the outdated statutes in Minnesota that are governing these kinds of things, but were never intended. These kinds of abuses and scams came about long after those laws were passed, and they were never intended to deal with them. So just wanted to highlight these things. I look forward to renewing my working relationships with the members that I have worked with over the years, and for the new members that I haven't yet worked with, I really look forward to meeting and working with you on these issues. And thank you for the time, Mr. Chair and members.
Certainly. Any questions for Mr. Elwood? I think a thank you note to the speaker would be in line for the creation of the committee. She gets the credit.
I'll sell it.
All right. Mr. Johnson, batting cleanup today from the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota, the Trade Association of the Minnesota-based, all the Minnesota-based companies, of which there's quite a few, and then, frankly, most of the companies also doing business here that you and most of your constituents buy their auto and homeowners and life, disability, and long-term care and annuities, and if there's businesses, any and all of the coverages they buy. If we have time, Mr. Chairman, I know the answer to Representative Scully's question. If you want to loop back to that when I get done, there is
be glad to
specific references and funds that she was asking about that came into play in the budget debate in recent years. But the Insurance Federation, Mr. Chairman, we have a team of three people up here that you will all be seeing regularly. In addition to myself, Robin Rowan over here on this side will be up here, and then Mark Culver are three of us. And so we encourage you to call us, ask us questions. We view our job up here to give you information. We're problem solvers in how we deal with issues that you confront. And frankly, there'll be a multitude of bills in all likelihood that you will have up here, and they directly affect the bottom line of what consumers in this state pay for products, the whole range of products. So, again, as an industry, we have some 70,000 jobs in the state, direct employment. It's a payroll of over $5 billion. And then the service and related jobs, the average salaries are some $75,000 a year. These are jobs that you buy houses on. My description of those jobs. They're found all over the place in terms of the cities, but in the suburbs. Go up north outside of Duluth and down in Cottonwood and down in Owatonna. There's a lot of jobs, again, in the industry. These are highly sought-after jobs. It's highly competitive in the financial services industry, and states look to get these jobs. And I say that, Mr. Chairman, because, it's important. And one of the things that we will do, too, is to have conversations with you all about the state of Minnesota laws. Commissioner Wilson provided an overview. We've worked with the legislature in the last 2 years and passed very important insurance regulatory modernization bills. They're dry and boring sometimes, but they're really important to keep our laws tuned up. Because trust me, when Governor Doyle and former Governor Vilsack and every other governor in the state likes to get these jobs, because these jobs are wired, they're high-tech electronic, and they're movable. It's just the reality. So we have a great base here, Mr. Chairman. We're pleased with that. I'm a native Minnesotan. This is home. This is all I've ever known. So I've been up here a lot of years and have a lot of that history. If I could just mention a couple of things, and if there's time, as an association, and just to give you just a quick flavor, and Commissioner Wilson mentioned it, we led the initiative to pass creating the insurance fraud unit at the Minnesota Commerce Department, including raising the money to pay for it. Now, fraud is an enormous problem affecting consumers. It's probably somewhere from $500 to $1,000 a year per household in added insurance costs for the fraud impact. So we have made material progress. We've passed good laws. We've worked with, again, you all, the Commerce. We've worked with the Attorney General's office, criminal code provisions. People shouldn't be taking money out of these insurance systems dishonestly. Everybody pays for that. So we've made great progress in Minnesota on the fraud front. Last year, we worked very closely with the firefighters, the fire chiefs, the fire departments to create a funding source, create a fire safety account to pay for firefighter training, the state fire marshal's office. That's coming on board later this year. We work closely with nursing homes to create long-term care partnership program to grow the private long-term care market, which I think everybody here knows we have to do that. The budget ramifications of an aging population and what's happening, we need to look at that. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll probably stop, because I know we're at the appointed hour, and I'd be happy to maybe return to this question either now or afterwards or whatever works with you or any other questions that the committee has. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any other questions for Mr. Johnson? Then we'll go into a brief overtime for the entire committee's sake. If you take a shot at Representative Scalzi's question, Representative Scalzi, do you want to
Mr. Chairman, the two funds that came in play, I don't have with me the exact year, but one of them is the workers' compensation assigned risk plan that's directly governed by the Commerce Department. And there were some monies removed out of that fund as per an order issued by the then Commerce Commissioner. The larger amount of money that came into budget play was the Special Compensation Fund at the Department of Labor and Industry, where there was legislation passed and actually subsequent court litigation regarding the constitutionality of that legislation that was passed regarding some $350 million of surplus in that fund. So we could get, mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, more really, nitty-gritty detail of it, but those were the two funds. There were surplus dollars, and at the end of all that, there was a resolution between the legislature, the courts, and where that money ended up. and part of it was in as part of the overall budget solution.
Representative Scalzi.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson, thank you. As one of the members of the committee who actually pays work comp insurance, it's interesting to me, and it's been an issue for me. So I'd like to talk to you a little bit after the committee.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Johnson, thank you for your time. Members, with that, we stand adjourned.